Gentlemen, it's time to get in touch with your guy side at POP Fishing and Marine. Explore the marine part of POP. Just past the cash register, through the big doorway, a huge warehouse, open to everyone, filled with boating parts and supplies. A genuine metrosexual free zone. Real work gloves, heavy duty boots, foul weather jackets. No pastel colors here, only marine blue, bright safety orange, zinc and stainless steel. Gear for sailboats and powerboats, pumps, engine parts, trailer parts, coolers tough enough to hold ice for 12 days, anchors, meat smokers. It's time to get your man up and your gear on. Our experts will help you find exactly what you need, and if we don't have it, we'll bring it in for you. Let your guy side out to play, guys. Gear, glory, we got it. POP Fishing and Marine on Pier 38 next to Nico's.
You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, come on in and learn some stuff. Well, welcome back. Like I said a few minutes ago, talk again or meet my friend John Konecko. John, like a lot of us here, has to wear a lot of hats. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine. He is involved in the fisheries to the max. Today's hat, he is with the Hawaii Seafood Council, and he's a seafood safety specialist. So in that introduction, John, I hope people already know what to expect. Because we've had a couple of scares lately. The most recent, salmonella. We had this hep A before. And here we come into the holidays. I just felt morally obligated to make people feel a little safe going into that. All they have to do is know where to buy their fish and how to take care of them. What's going on? First of all, it's the most recent thing with the limu, with the ogo, salmonella. What causes that, and what can we do to avoid it?
Thanks, Mike. One of the things that we need to recognize is there's many different species and varieties of salmonella. So when we say salmonella, we need to kind of bury or dig in deep and figure out exactly what strain it is. Sure. That tells us a lot about where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. But salmonella is a potential bacteria that will cause an infection. Mm-hmm. If you're eating product or water that is contaminated with salmonella, certain strains that you can become infected with it, and then you mm-hmm. get ill. So it takes time to grow inside of you to cause problems.
Does it do? I mean, when you say cause problems, what's the worst can it get? Can it ever be fatal? Can salmonella kill you?
Well, I wouldn't be able to report on that unless it was some kind of a secondary issue that people were having. But we'll leave that to the physicians.
But generally speaking, it's just an unpleasant situation.
Well, in general speaking, it's a infectious disease with diarrhea and other GI symptoms.
Now, there is a difference between this and other things, because from what I led to understand is salmonella, once you have it, you are carrying it. So maybe it's kind of contagious.
Well, there are carriers that have individuals that may carry it mm-hmm. and have carrier status without overt clinical disease, but then others are just going to pass it.
Yeah. And so the scare that we just went through was limu, and I guess, and it's easy to see because where it's grown, maybe the water wasn't the greatest. But what I did see, and I don't know if you agree or not, but it seemed to me that the farmer, the guy that owns it, manned up and said, okay, we're going to do whatever we have to do. They've been in business a long time. It's something happened to change their water to the point where their stuff got mm-hmm. tainted, right?
Well, when we think about it, first of all, let's step back. And if the news reports or the reporting is coming that people are getting some or have become ill from salmonella, infected from salmonella, from eating ahi limu poke, mm-hmm. then the big question is, does it come from the tuna? Does it come from the other ingredients? Yeah. Or does it come from the limu? And mm-hmm. apparently it's been identified to have come from the limu.
This time.
Right. So the next question in this kind of food safety mm-hmm. investigations mm-hmm. is the immediate response to farm food-based food mm-hmm. safety. That would be agricultural products, cilantro, whatever yeah. you're growing that you're not going to cook.
Mm-hmm.
You need to start out, and especially start out with the safety of the water that you're mm-hmm. growing it in, and also irrigating or washing the vegetables.
Is cooking the way to sort of mitigate issues?
Well, cooking, you heat things up enough, and the bacteria and virus will be
eliminated.
Okay. Eliminated, because they're just proteins. They'll get mm-hmm. cooked.
Yeah, okay.
But we're eating it raw. Yeah, that's why it's yeah. vulnerable. So it's yeah, inherently
so,
risky.
So is the natural knee-jerk reaction got to be the fish? You know, it's raw. It's got to be the fish. We don't eat raw chicken, probably because it doesn't taste very good.
Well,
or it's kind of chewy. But we do eat a lot of raw fish here, and so we have to just say that that I guess care should be used. You know, whatever, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, we need to. Well, first of all, you're relying on the government oversight
mm-hmm.
on the farm for food safety. And then if you're a processor selling yeah. into a wholesale market, then there would be some kind of government oversight. Mm-hmm. And for seafood coming off of fishing boats, that would be FDA. And from the from the farms, generally a combination of USDA and FDA.
Is it safe to say, is it accurate to say that here in our fishery, we're under much more scrutiny than a farmer is? You know, it seems to me that there are standards and procedures and practices that you can get really dinged on, and that may or may not translate to the farm.
Right. Well, and thanks for bringing that up. You know, the whole new modernization effort of food safety to improve the quality and mm-hmm. safety of the American food supply. Well, it's really a big initiative now because we shifted from primarily domestic, mm-hmm. local production of food, meat, poultry, mm-hmm. what have you, dairy, to a lot of imports or coming from centralized processing on the mainland. But it's the imports that I'm really concerned about. So the scrutiny on seafood started first with the new modernization implemented in 1997.
Okay, explain that a little bit. What is that?
So that means that we're applying science-based mm-hmm. risk analysis mm-hmm. to controlling our food safety risks. And mm-hmm. so we're going to look very carefully at a process flow diagram from the farm or the boat all mm-hmm. the way into the finished product mm-hmm. and look for the key steps. Is it catching? Is it dressing the fish, taking the gills guts out? Or washing, storing, processing, delivery.
Any number of things that can happen to throw that piece of fish into a problem.
Absolutely, yeah. because yeah. most of that, and I teach food safety, and mm-hmm. I have to express to people that, for instance, if you have a salmonella outbreak with tuna, the immediate question is: Do tuna naturally swim around in the ocean? Are they contaminated or infected with salmonella? And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
So where does salmonella come from? It comes from people and their practices.
Yep.
And so we're coming right back to looking very carefully at where are the breakdowns in sanitation
yep.
or at the farm. You know, so I hate to say it's a yeah. fun investigation, yeah, but you're going to go back through it.
We're going to talk about that a little bit with John Kaneko also today, because many of you that have inquired about the fish auction tours that I used to do years ago are being done by John's folks now, and they're really, really terrific in the amount of information that is exchanged. And one of the first things people get surprised about when they go to the tour at the fish auction is that they have to go through a sheep dip, like a foot bath. I think that's the eye opener. Most people think, what's that for? That's to eliminate as much germs as we can from inside this room.
Right. So you don't want to walk into a food handling facility
yeah,
and
yeah.
track in any pathogens that you might have walked through.
What I think is fascinating, though, and you can explain how technology really led this. When one of the biggest questions I used to get asked, and I'm sure you too and all of your folks, is what's that tag on the fish mean? Because they all have the uniform product code things on it. And that is just another piece of armor so that we can determine when there's a problem where it came from. I think it's fascinating.
Right. And the flip side of that, Mike, is that we need to have, it's a requirement that we have the ability to recall
mm-hmm.
our products in the face of food safety outbreaks.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, our traceability system would be if let's say someone, heaven forbid, got sick at a restaurant, then the immediate response would be, okay, isolate
that. What did they eat?
What did they eat? Yeah. Isolate a piece of fish, come up with some kind of an idea of what the illness could have been caused by, and then start doing your testing and monitoring backwards. So we work on the paper trail. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's just a paper trail to track where did you get your fish, and then you're going right back up the chain to the wholesaler that delivered it, and then where did, and we can trace every local fish that has landed through the auction by that barcode system.
It's fascinating.
All the way through the transaction, at the auction to the wholesaler, and if the wholesalers are on it, they can track from the barcode out to the boat, all the way out to the restaurant.
Yeah, and this is, I guess, for want of a better expression, another system of checks and balances is just to ensure that local fish is what it is. It's been handled well, and it's safe to eat.
Yes, and it helps us because we do have the, first of all, we have the government oversight for food safety, which is very, very critical here for us. And because we have that oversight, we're given assurances that the plans that our food safety plans that are put in place are not only effective, but they are being implemented on a consistent basis.
You know, that being said, you mentioned something a while ago, and it bears repeating. In back in the day when we used to hunt and gather, you know, I'm the fisherman, you're the farmer. I give you some fish, you give me some taro, and everybody's happy. This collection process, what people don't understand is they all know that nationally and internationally there's big differences in the cost of labor and all of that stuff. But I think people would be flabbergasted to know in some of the stats that you all keep of the percentage of fish that we eat in Hawaii that's not from here. We think it's all local caught. No, it's not. I mean, there's an awful lot that we eat that's not. And I'm wondering if there's any, you know, any paper trail that we can use on those fish like we can use on our local fish, and my guess is no.
Well, there's going to be a paper trail, yes. Mm-hmm. How much resolution you have is the other story. So it's always going to come down.
You know where it came from, but who's going to do something about it?
Well, the other thing is you can track that case of or that product back to the supplier, but if the supplier did not cut his lot or production lot down to a manageable size, the recall would be in like if you have a E. coli outbreak in a meat packing plant and you produced a million pounds of hamburger in 24 hours and you didn't cut down your lots into 10-ton lots during the 24-hour period, you get one problem, you have to recall everything.
Let's look at another recent case that got everybody scared about eating scallops, and particularly the scallops that came in. And the restaurant took huge hits. And it was something, I guess, had been, standard operating procedure. They get the scallops, they get it come in. This was a different disease, though. This was a more threatening thing, this hepatitis A.
Yeah, hepatitis A is a virus. Mm-hmm. And hepatitis A is actually not very common in the United States anymore. And so when the outbreak happened, that had to do with the epidemiologist, the state, which did a great job, by the way, in going back and doing the investigations, but keeping the public and the industry aware of the process, because you still need to ultimately protect and limit the exposure to the to new cases. And so they identified a common food product and a food source, and it came down to raw scallops.
Right.
And so raw scallops, then the next question is, where did they come from? Mm-hmm. And so they're going right up the chain or back up the chain to find out where it came from, and a local wholesaler had distributed it. Mm-hmm. Now, they were not the importer of record. The person that or the company that imports the product is essentially responsible for assuring U.S. style food safety assurances or systems in the foreign plants. Gotcha. And so the company locally actually brought in the product from the primary importer who was responsible for the food safety system, but they got dinged. Basically, they got caught up in this. And what happens is the way that product is handled, from what I understand, comes packaged, it's frozen, and the local distributor just takes a case and distributes the packages. So there was no handling or cross-contamination once it got here. And so I think they've from what I understand, they've traced it back to a plant. I thought it was a plant in the Philippines, I believe.
Isn't it fascinating, though, John, that technology has accelerated the process to the point where it's of value to you? You guys are in food safety. You have all of this stuff at your fingertips to quickly do this. I would imagine that this particular episode, there would have been hundreds, if not thousands, of people that would have been sick way back when because of the inability to communicate where it came from and quickly determine these things and do the process of elimination fast.
Right, and that's where the State Department of Health has got to be congratulated mm-hmm. on that. And I think that we actually have a very, very good yeah. Department of Health here to be able to do these food safety investigations. And they're cautious in not just, you know, creating great market mm-hmm. and public concerns, overblown concerns, but to also, you know, strike yeah. a balance, to limit yeah. the exposure, but at the same time, you know, not go overblown.
I find it all very fascinating. And I think true to that also is sometimes, you know, local families particularly say, oh, I can tell, I can look, I can see, you know, and it's very true. But what does come to mind is if we take something that a lot of us eat because of economics, a lot of meat because you think it's valuable, and this is farm fish. Like right now, there's an awful lot of people eating farm salmon. And the farm salmon, if you didn't color it, would be like gray, ugly meat, probably with most of the same nutrients in it. But isn't it interesting that people will gravitate towards it now because it looks just like the fresh salmon, and it's $2 a pound or $3 a pound cheaper.
Even more, yeah.
Yeah.
It's got a lot to do with it. Well, I'm not, from a public health standpoint, mm-hmm. I think the value to the individual for consuming more seafood, wherever you're going to get it, the yeah. real deal seafood,
yeah.
I think is a positive thing sure. for public health. So now we make the distinction. If I was an Alaska king salmon troller,
yeah.
I'd be thinking that the farm-raised Atlantic salmon is the most evil stuff on earth.
Sure. sure.
But the reality mm-hmm. is we need people to...
Sure.
For our public health, we need more fish. And it's not all going to come from the ocean. So yeah, farming is good. It's part of the equation.
Yeah, and they say that. And I've come to the fact, to terms with, and I know you see it a lot, is we deal with the fishery, particularly the longline fishery and the net to table food sure. reef fish. And so these people would in the past were vehemently opposed to this, or starting to understand, wait a minute, I buy it because I'll just buy more, or I'll eat, you know, in other words, if I need to get the nutrients out of it and I don't think it's got enough, I'll just eat more. But a lot of people just say, look, I want to feed my family fish.
Right.
And I can't afford $15 a pound, but I can take eight.
Right.
You know,
and a lot of it comes down to, as you say, yeah. personal economy. Yeah. Right.
What about tuna? Let's talk about our favorite tuna for a while, because I know at the Hawaii Seafood Council, we are, you know, really protective of local fish. When we say ahi or we say mahi-mahi, we mean that it's our local fish. I've often been, and you and I see each other, John and I see each other regularly at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council meetings, particularly the Fishers Forum, which I've been hooked up with for a number of years now, and I'm flabbergasted at the amount of people that have come to know this thing, this term tailpipe ahi, and we need to really explain why that's done and why it may be perceived to some in the safety industry as a problem.
Okay, well, what you're referring to is the process of treating animal proteins that have mm-hmm. iron in the muscle that okay. give it the red color. With carbon monoxide gas,
yeah.
whether it comes through filtered wood smoke or is commercially generated. The carbon monoxide binds with the myoglobin in the muscle, displaces the oxygen or the carbon dioxide, and once it binds the myoglobin, turns it a bright cherry red,
yeah.
which is really an unnatural color because mm-hmm. of the color scheme, and we don't normally operate in our bodies with that high level of carbon monoxide. So once the whole idea is that once the myoglobin is fixed with carbon monoxide, that red color does not degrade under normal freezer temperatures. You don't mm-hmm. need an yeah. ultra low temperature freezer to keep the sashimi quality of red color. Japanese market eats ultra low temperature frozen tuna that's mm. caught in distant waters, but it's frozen to minus 60 degrees and then it's stored that way, brought back to Japan, and it looks indistinguishable from the fresh high quality. But the gas product can then be shipped by surface in regular surface containers at the normal freezer temperatures, and
which is
it enters
considerably
the market,
higher temperatures,
much than higher than the ultra low temperature freezing at minus 60, and it ends up entering in, the issue for us in Hawaii is that it does enter into the mainland market and our local market, and is it competes with fresh tuna, but the connoisseurs are people that recognize the difference between the real deal domestic, the real deal high quality fish. They're happy. It's the folks that are either not are being deceived by or not aware of what the process means.
There's the key.
Is the real issue.
Yeah. I wonder one thing, though, John. I want to make sure that people understand. We often brag about we're the best at this or we're the worst at that or whatever it is. But we here locally, I think, are really more in touch with what we put in our mouth as far as taste, texture, and these things than there might be at, you know, in Nebraska going to a sushi restaurant, because that may not, that palate may not be, you know, like ours are.
Well, I would say that you're right. We the Hawaii population on average eats about 2.5 times what the normal average American of seafood. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, we look at the quality and variety of fish that we have offered to us just right up the street here at Tamashiro Market. You look at the variety there, and there is a price point for everybody, you know, and this is really the people's fish. So here we it's culturally significant, it's nutritionally and public health great significance, and significance for economic drivers and also for employment. So it's very important for us.
Yeah, and you know, that's another reason. Maybe we should really sort of explain what the Hawaii Seafood Council is, but and we'll do that. But we also got to tell you folks that every bit of information that you can provide or get when something goes wrong is valuable to somebody. And if you went through this discussion we just had a few moments ago about the hepatitis A breakout, which was pretty rare, but it happened, it actually, when you think about it, was a lot kinder than it could have been. I mean, you know, there's some really spooky consequences to that. And also, a lot of people say, well, that's it for that restaurant chain. The place opened the stores the next day. People just say, I'll pass on the scallops, but I'll have everything else. In other words, it's hard to blame those guys. They didn't do anything on purpose.
Well, yes, absolutely. And through the investigation, it turns out to be the raw material, not the, remember we talked about
not even the handling.
The fingers and practices, right? People's and practices. It's not there at the restaurant that happened. It was opening the bag and there it was.
But look at all the other places that had to either curtail operations, change things, put people on leave, do things, all in preparation for the worst. In other words, all right, if we don't know where it's coming from, so let's just shut for a little bit.
Right. Well, I think that's a precautionary approach, and that's dealing with the confidence in the in the market too. Mm. Unfortunately, you can clean up your shop, you can start decontaminating everything, but the point is you didn't cause the problem
cause
to begin
it in the
with.
First place. Yeah, I sort of laughed this morning earlier because I knew you were going to come in and we were going to get this recorded segment done for the show this weekend, and I was reading a story about salmonella cheese. There's this huge big mountain of cheese somewhere. It's all going to come back because of the cutting boards that it was used to shred it, or the machines that they used to shred it hadn't been properly cleaned, and it doesn't take much. But the company, in advance of repercussions, just said, that's it. Boom, just get it all off the market, bring it all back.
Right. So that's at that level, you know, you've got a reputation to maintain. And you need to do the right thing to rebuild that reputation. And what are they doing? They're limiting liability.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
That product could be more contaminated.
Well, you know,
you need to figure it off the shelf.
There's another issue here, and this comes up on my regular show during the week all the time. We've become such a litigious society at every level that we'll call a lawyer before we call an ambulance. I mean, you know, it's to that point. And so, obviously, this would be a good junction to sort of explain to everybody what the Hawaii Seafood Council is, what's its mission, who are they?
Okay, it's Hawaii Seafood Council is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Yeah.
And it does research, but it also does outreach and education on seafood and fishing, Hawaii fishing industry practices, and how important this industry is to us, but really focusing on the seafood that we eat in terms of quality, health benefits, mm-hmm. but also health effects, which would be seafood safety issues. And so, and then we also deal with education and some projects, research projects that revolve around a larger category of sustainable fisheries. Mm-hmm. And so that would have to do with the protected species interactions, that type
what,
of thing.
It's a 501c3. What funds it?
What funds it? I have some support from the industry. We also do, even some of our outreach efforts are things that generate funds. I also do some advising and training through the organization.
Yeah, the reason I ask is I want people to understand that that by and large that, you know, there's certain things where there may be even grant monies available where somebody can say, look, we realize that there's an issue here. We have the expertise to get out there and do this. Can you fund us so that we can do our right. study, do our outreach, and do our dissemination of materials?
Yes, and thanks for bringing that up.
Because you got some neat stuff.
Well, the development of the research, conducting the research that is fueling the outreach and education and training that we do was largely funded through the Department of Commerce, NOAA fisheries. And because it's in support of a NOAA-managed fishery, because we need to realize that the major fishery that we have in Hawaii is actually a federally managed fishery. It's managed by NOAA. And it operates all offshore fishes outside of 50 miles at the minimum.
And you know, gang, we on this segment, which is brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, we go out of our way to tell you how it really was designed and, in effect, is a bottoms-up organization. So that means that the information going to the feds or the NOAA fisheries comes, if you are forthcoming with your mana'o and your help, it becomes valuable, because otherwise you are the victim of consequence. If you don't speak up and add in, you can't expect anybody to have intelligent materials to base their decisions on.
Yeah, absolutely. And the function of the council, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, which is one of eight councils regionally across the country, is really a great, I think it's a great success story of how U.S. management has occurred in the marine fisheries. And its primary function is to do what some of the scientists in the agencies are not necessarily set up to do as well, but its mandate is to really collect scientific advice as well as stakeholder input from the various user groups and those that don't even support fisheries.
Yeah, exactly.
But to get the public through this public process to accumulate that diverse input and then come up with the basically maintain a fishery management plan and the amendments to that plan, which are basically vetted through the science, vetted through the process of the public process, and those are recommended regulations that go forward to the Department of Commerce. And the ultimate regulations are made, decision-making is by the Secretary of Commerce.
Yeah, and you know, there are a series of meetings that are held in different islands and different places at different times, and you can go to wpcouncil.org and identify some of them, because it is critical that you participate in the process, as we've learned. We could spend 4 hours on the Papahanaumokuakea situation and what impact it has on the fisheries. And there is talks now on the East Coast, on the West Coast, in the Gulf of Mexico, and in the Pacific about maybe having this new administration. Maybe we can take a look at some of these things and make some tweaking. I would think that anybody that gets into this stuff, even in the Obama administration that wanted to do this, was probably thinking that this is what we need, this is and how we do it. But maybe some of our fishery got impacted to the point where we're worried about more imported product rather than less.
Right. That's any federal action, especially an executive order
sweeping
action that has no act of Congress behind it, that impacts an industry like us. I mean, for the state of Hawaii you can see how dependent our population is for eating seafood, which is a really public health issue, but it's also our number one food producing system based on economic value at the farm gate or at the dockside. And so this particular fishery is over, 95 million. Our commercial fisheries combined,
yeah,
or over 110 million. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the next, you know, what are these other commodities or food commodities that we produce in Hawaii, and are there anywhere near 100
pale in million? Comparison, really.
They are nowhere near it.
Yeah.
The agricultural sector or function or segment that is a higher value is really the hybrid seed.
Sure.
But that we don't eat hybrid seeds.
We don't eat hybrid seed. We get rid of them. Yeah, yeah.
And so there you go. So we don't.
There is a valiant effort, John, on the state trying to increase availability, loans, property. We have land. We don't have land. We have plenty of land. But even if it quadrupled or 10 times its efficiency, the fishery still value-wise outstrips it.
Well, value is one thing, mm-hmm. and it's a unique product for us, and it drives. It really has such a great economic driver to it, right out into our primary business, which is going to be tourism here.
Yeah,
people don't you only go out and shop and go to the beach so many times. You got to eat three times a day.
Three times a day,
and
more they hear about us, we have this magic. And this is, I want to spend a minute on this because it's a burr under my saddle. We have a lot of restaurants in Waikiki serving, quote, mahi-mahi. And it is dolphin fish. And that's about the only comparison that it has to local mahi-mahi. And I'm thinking only because it's so unique. Everybody that eats that fish for the first time, a real good piece of local mahi-mahi, they can't believe it. Mm-hmm. We take it for granted, right? I catch a mahi-mahi and some people say, it's a mahi. Oh, really? Well, bring it, you know. Isn't that an example of what we're talking about, that there are people taking advantage of all the advertising and promotion? Come to Hawaii, eat this beautiful local fish, and when it's not, that's disappointing.
Yeah, it is. I would be, if I'm coming here to eat ahi, I want to eat the real deal.
I want to eat the real deal.
And those that are discriminating and outlets that are truthful in labeling, I think they do us a good service.
Let me ask you this, because I think this is important. Put on your other hat for a minute. The imported fish, a lot of times it depends on where it comes from. Now, mahi-mahi is a pelagic surface running game fish, so it's probably the least bit. But what about things that are raised in pens where there are considerable challenges to the water that it's in, to contaminated water, to chemicals? We really don't know what that is.
Right. So that's why the federal food safety controls that we were talking about earlier would really ask and put the onus of responsibility on the importer in the United States to document where that product came from. So if you're importing shrimp, for instance, or is it farm raised or did it come from a boat? If it was farm raised, where was that farm placed? And especially things that concentrate stuff from the environment or contaminants or potentially contaminants from the environment.
We're talking shellfish, oysters, all of that kind
Absolutely.
Of stuff.
Absolutely. Those are the scary ones because if you're not going to eat them raw, then the quality of the growing water has to be suitable for human consumption.
Right. Yeah.
And the quality of the water is going to tell all the story of whether or not the shellfish is safe. So we need to look and also start to look at accumulation of metals and other types of contaminants so that we would be looking very carefully at. If you're buying, for instance, clams from China, I need to have some system that of assurance that says these clams are coming from a growing area that are now tested and certified by the local government authorities to be free of these contaminants.
Yeah, and you know, this is a very important thing. And I know we could spend hours on another subject, and that is the question that always comes up, or the fear that always comes up, at least in my social circles, is, and it sort of, you know, vacillates up and down depending on a lot of things, and that's mercury. Oh, yeah, mercury in the fish, you're going to die of mercury. I have seen this to the point where it almost put the fishery out of business a long time ago. The tofu industry almost went out of business a couple of times. Let's talk about mercury for a while. I mean, you know, there are tuna have a high concentration of mercury. How bad is it, and who should be worried about it?
Okay, well, let's talk about the reported cases of mercury poisoning. And we talk in terms of outbreaks. Yeah, that would be two or more people that got sick from mercury from eating the same meal. Does the who records this federally would be the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. So how many cases of or outbreaks of mercury poisoning from eating seafood do they have on record?
I'm going to say three.
Zero.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's none. So it's none. So
it doesn't, I know it's really, really low.
It's low. It doesn't happen.
How about
happen.
Zero? Yeah.
How about zero? Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't occur. So when we look at risk, remember we talked about risk-based analysis and food safety controls. If you have never recorded the event, I cannot calculate risk because there's no numbers to work with.
No numbers, yeah.
And so at that point, I would say the risk that there are issues that have to do with the mercury that is naturally occurring in the seafood that we eat can I say it's zero?
Yeah.
I would say it is very, very low based on the lack of reported evidence. Now, the other science that, big question is why? Mm-hmm. Why isn't it?
Why isn't it?
We know that mercury is a toxin. Mm-hmm. We know that mercury is at high levels is a neurotoxin and can cause brain damage in neurologic signs. But here's the deal is if in the case where mercury is consumed, as it turns out, with in foodstuffs with and experimental diets with a equal or higher level of selenium, which is also a essential mineral for us, that there are no health effects.
Yeah, because the selenium knocks out the mercury.
The selenium binds the mercury, or mercury binds the selenium, either way you want to look at it.
How it goes.
And one is going to be sequestered and cause either problems. Now, if you have excess mercury and you bind up all your selenium, turns out we don't know of any essential function for mercury in the body. That's why it's not in your supplements.
Exactly. Yeah.
But selenium has an essential function, and it is an antioxidant enzymes that protect our brains from oxidative damage. So we put these two things together. We say mercury and selenium have an interaction. They bind together. Mm-hmm. Then we look at the ratios in the diet. We say if you're getting more mercury than selenium, you are destined for profound selenium deficiency. Once you get selenium,
simply means you need more selenium, not less mercury.
Right. So once you get selenium deficiency, your antioxidant enzymes that protect your brain are not going to be functioning or reproduced, and then you are on your way out for neurologic symptoms. But the opposite is occurring when you have an excess of selenium. What happens is whatever mercury is being consumed, if you have a 1-to-1 molar binding affinity of selenium for mercury, it means as long as you have an excess of selenium in your diet, you are still going to be in good shape.
And listen, I want to put that down, and I want to make sure before we run out of time here, I'm so, you know, it's so valuable to us to be able to spend some time with John Konecko. I want to let people know of the experience of coming down and seeing for themselves. You take, you know, a couple of dozen people a week through the fish auction. How can people find out a website where they can sign up, where they can call up? Because I do know that you want to know who's coming. How often do you do it, and what's this current schedule?
We have a website, and the address is www.hawaii-seafood.org. So go there, and there's a registration and a calendar for the tours that we offer. They're 90-minute tours, and for adults, $25, and for students, there's a discount.
It's the best $25 you can spend, and I know because I conducted similar tours with about 10% of the information that you disseminate. Because I went by the letting the kids touch the eyes of the ahi and stuff, but what you really do share with people, and it comes back to me all the time. It's very, very valuable stuff, and I think once you're empowered with knowledge. But I'm still, what are some of the biggest aha moments that you can see on people's faces that come? You always say there's no such thing as a dumb question. You got a question, what's your question?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are some of the big surprises?
Well, we have people from all over.
Different
walks of life. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I always ask people that come from the general public on the tour, where are they from? Mm-hmm. So across the country and... Mm-hmm. A lot of international visitors come, and then a lot of locals.
Yeah,
so
sometimes they'll have. Have you noticed the same thing I did? They're repeat people.
They
come back again and again. So they like it.
It turns out to be, we've had people keep coming, and they bring their families.
Sure.
Another visitor comes, they want to show up. And it's basically in 90 minutes, what we do is the basic premise is we want you to be happy and healthy consumers of Hawaii seafood.
Yeah.
We are going to explain to you where it comes from, who's catching it, how they do it, mm-hmm. who's managing it to make sure that it's safe and sustainable. Yeah. And with those, and then we go into the auction and take a look at the fish, mm-hmm. and then we can see species, we can look at the quality grading and quality determinants, how the auction works, and people take away from it a very, in 90 minutes, you're given an orientation to an industry that is from the source.
It makes you hungry. I'm telling you, it makes you hungry, not just to eat fish, but for more information. Obviously, right now, we're the week before Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is this coming week, I should say. It gets very, very busy at the United Fish Agency auction at this time of the year. When do you do these tours generally, and are there some times that you don't because of the season?
Yes, generally there's going to be, they would be done on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. Any particular groups that are large enough that want to do tours on other days can call up and just make a request, mm-hmm. and then we try to accommodate. I can't do them all, but sometimes we can do them during the week.
Yeah, and also you can always email the MikeBuckShow@gmail.com because I have the connection information for that. I think, though, that it's really good to know that, I don't want to say big brother, but certainly, you know, your cousins are looking after you. I mean, I know you have great pride in what you do, and also that is very, very valuable because people really do need to know. I mean, you know, the three made food groups are not burger, fries, and Coke. You got to get really some good stuff in you, and fish is the answer, at least in Hawaii.
It's good. It's good for us, and I think people need to know and feel confident in buying and consuming the product and supporting a local business that really is important to the people that work in it and the others in the market.
Somehow I knew you were going to say those things. John Kaneko, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing some time with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, and for those of you that want to know a little bit more about John or about the Hawaii Seafood Council, I'll be happy to answer an email. It's easy. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Have a great rest of the weekend. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. And don't forget, if somebody says, what are you going to bring to the potluck? Bring fish. You know somebody else is going to make the turkey. We'll see you next time.